Okay, back on the record, December 15, 2023, 4 o'clock p.m. Silverview Appeals. We are still in the appellant's rebuttal, Ms. Clinton, under direct with Mr. Adams. So, Ms. Clinton, go ahead.
Great, thank you. So we were talking about the feasibility, some of the discussion about feasibility of parking. And I believe one of Mr. McCormick said if we did that, we would need to make the building higher. Do they have to go up a story?
They do not have to go up a story. There's many ways to create unit plans that would still keep the building at a lower level.
And then just previously when we were talking about the ability to you can build on a slope, you can build up slope. You mentioned there were some exhibits, and I believe they were illustrative in the previous hearing. But this examiner hasn't seen those. So I do want to bring those up as examples of the way buildings can be built on a slope, on a bit of a hill. So I'm just going to share my screen really quick. All right, are you able to see that?
I am. Yep.
Okay. Does that show that shows the image?
Yeah, that's a relatively famous project in Central Coast of California called Sea Ranch that is a multifamily residential project that steps down the hill towards the water, in this case, towards the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, and Ms. Clinton, where does this come from again? Is this a new exhibit, rebuttal exhibit, or what?
This was an illustrative exhibit as part of the previous hearing. I did email Ms. Walston and ask them to be added into this record because
Right.
but I don't know what exhibit number they now have for this one. Ms. Walston, can you help me?
Oh yeah, I remember I did admit the illustrative exhibit says an F number. Yeah, that's fine. I just needed to know it was in the record already. I do recall that
Right.
exhibit, so go ahead.
Sorry, it's F62. Great,
Okay.
thank you. Okay, I'll just make a note of that myself. And was that is F62 all of our list illustrative exhibits or just illustrative exhibit 4?
So it is all the illustrative exhibits in the folder. There's actually multiple. So I don't actually have a page number for you yet, but it includes all of yours and yeah, it's a compilation.
Okay. So somewhere in that F63 range. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So Mr. Adams, can you just this is a representative example of the ability to build
Yes,
multiple.
at Sea Ranch, you can and you can kind of clearly see it in this view of the side of the building that the units are stepping down, the floor levels are stepping down with the site, as opposed to being a flat floor level just superimposed upon the site, which is what the current Silverview application is trying to do. This project clearly shows the windows and the siding stepping down with the site, and the floor levels move with the land.
Okay, and then here's another view.
That's another view of the same project.
Okay. All right, that's the following page. And then here's another example here.
Yeah, this is showing how buildings can flow with the site. I believe this is it was a while ago. I don't quite remember the name of this project, but it's over on the other side of Daybob Bay or somewhere over there. I can't quite
Is
honestly
that
quite can't remember.
does that is that Alderbrook?
Yeah, thank you. It's Alderbrook, yes.
Awesome. Okay, and then here's another view of that.
Yep.
So up on this higher level, we only have a few stories exposed, but then it steps down with the land, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And something like that would be feasible on this site, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
In fact, I mean, I would like to talk about the slope a little bit in general, to talk about what kind of a hardship the slope really is on this site. I think it's been overstated.
Okay. All right. 1 second. Let me pull up that. Right. So let me jump to slope discussion. Okay. All right. I believe Yeah. So when Mr. McCormick was testifying about, you know, how they originally came up with the design of this project, there was reference to unique topography and slope and as why they oriented the building a certain way. What is your response to that?
Right. And in addition, saying parking is infeasible under the building because of the slope and so on and so forth. And the other point we touched on earlier, the orientation of the buildings is infeasible because of the slope. It doesn't actually really stand to reason because the slope is not particularly onerous on the site. I mean, first of all, we live in the wonderful Pacific Northwest. There aren't many flat sites available. But this site is actually pretty darn flat by any reasonable measure. If you wouldn't mind showing the survey, which is F26.
Yes,
26.
There, I'll share the screen 1 second. All right. F26.
These are the civil plans. And I think it's the second sheet of this exhibit.
Okay.
The applicant was trying to talk about the contours of the site when they were testifying.
Is it this one? Is it page two?
It's this one. And couldn't find this exhibit, but this is the exhibit showing the existing grading, the existing contour lines on the site. So we're going to have to do some zooming in, but I would say that right now we're in this exhibit. We have a north arrow that points up on this screen and on this sheet in the lower left hand corner. So this plan is oriented the way we've been largely looking at the plans already in this testimony, with north being up in the northeastern corner is the high point of the site, and then its southeastern corner is the southwestern corner is the low point of the site. So this is our high point at the northeast, and the southeast is this corner, and this is low down here. And I'm more than happy to zoom in if required. And analyze these contours, or everybody can believe me, but this corner is approximately 58.5 feet in elevation, and I'm pointing to the northeast corner of the site. And this corner is approximately 16.5 feet in elevation.
And what is that? Where is that from? Where are those numbers from?
We would have to zoom in and look at the contour lines, and I'd be happy to do that with you.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure it is this page too. We don't want to look at the ones with the drawing on them.
No, because the issue is whether the existing grading on the site presents, some sort of impediment to certain designs on the project, and that somehow the slope of the site is something that is so difficult to work with that they're forced into less desirable design solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But if you zoom in there, and then we're going to have to find a number and the sort of the top center. Zoom back up. Yep. The top center of your screen, you see a 50 at the top of the this particular contour line. I don't know how to explain it much better than that, but that means this contour line is 50 feet, but above sea level or above the datum. And if we count, these are 1 foot contours. We go 51, 52, 53, 54, 55. The next bold line is often some multiple of, in this case, 5, and 55, 56, 57, 58, and I'll just round it up to 58.5 at that upper corner there. So that's how we determine that northwestern corner is approximately 58.5.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. And I believe Mr. McCormick's testimony was that there was roughly 40 feet of fall across the site, and he characterized that as unusual or unique.
Correct. I grant him it's at least 40 feet. I calculated 42 feet, mm-hmm. which makes it slightly steeper. So no argument about 40 feet of fall across the site. Mm-hmm. The issue is that it's a huge site, and we have, I have to reemphasize that. I don't think people understand how big this, it's massive. It's 2.5 city blocks long and wide. And so the diagonal dimension you could, across the site is approximately 960 feet. We get that by doing, going back to our math from high school and taking these two numbers. I'm circling the numbers 928 on the north side of the property. I could actually be more generous and circle 926 on the south side of the property, and take 250, which I've circled at the east end of the property. And we can all remember, this is actually perfect because we can all remember our trigonometry from high school, where I get to draw a triangle here and say that the upside of that triangle is 250 and the bottom side is 926 feet plus 927 feet. And I can do my trigonometry, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, and calculate the distance down the middle of the site of roughly, and people can check my math, about 960 feet of distance along the diagonal. And this is the diagonal why the applicant is justifying orienting the buildings towards this, along this diagonal. They're saying, well, we're going to go with the slope. I'm going to orient the buildings across the slope because the slope is so onerous that there's no other way to build these buildings. Well, when you do the math and you take 200, you know, you take these dimensions and you take the height now from the high point here, which we establish at 58 feet, 0.5, and the low point, which is down here, and you take that height dimension, and we all concede that it's about 42 feet of height. When you divide out 42 by 960, you get approximately 4%.
Okay, and would you characterize 4% as steep or unusual or unique topography?
4% is almost considered flat. By for a reference point, if you had a sloped surface in a building or along the length of a walkway, it would have to be just under 4%, I mean, just over 4% to be considered a slope at all. So in fact, handicap ramps that we all encounter, whether we walk on them or not, that we encounter on every project, commercial project and whatnot, are 8%. They're twice this. So this is very flat across the entire length of this property. This is a big, long property with very, very modest grade. It's not a lot. There are localized areas, of course, that are steeper than other areas. But I would also point out, if you wouldn't mind, I'll delete my markups here, looking at the civil plan, which I believe is the next sheet in this same exhibit, the civil design.
Mm-hmm.
What's fascinating is I can start circling all of the pipes that are along the north side of the property, which is going to be slightly steeper. The north side's going to be slightly steeper than the diagonal because it's a slightly shorter dimension. And we see that there's percentages attached to all of these pipe slopes. And I think this kind of came up in the previous testimony about how some of these pipes are really flat, right, across the site. I heard the tail end of some of that testimony, but forget that for a second. Just looking at these slopes, all of these slopes of these pipes that are running along are 3%, 2%, 2%, some very small numbers because the site's so darn flat.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean?
2%, by the way, in my world, and is the minimum that I can put a surface, an architectural surface, and expect water to really drain off of it. So 2% is a very shallow, so a lot of these pipes are closing in on 2%.
So what does that mean in terms of the perceived constraints on the design for this site?
Again, I don't see it. I don't understand what the constraints are. I don't understand the claims that it's infeasible. The application needs to be a lot more demonstrative to me of why there are constraints due to the slope, because I simply do not understand it.
Okay. Okay. I think the next thing I just want to highlight, and it's going back a little bit to some of the previous discussion, but I think it's worth noting is, you know, you've characterized Mr. McCormick's testimony as focusing largely on the zoning code and ignoring the design standards. And then during his testimony, they're like, well, we came back with different versions or things like that. But I just want to highlight here, this is Exhibit F7. This is the hearing examiner's decision. And you see this section here, this is on page 15.
Yes.
Where the project is designed while compliant with the county's traditional zoning requirements. So she addressed that, did not comply with the parking or the design standard requirements. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
Right. And so then we have Mr. McCormick's testimony, who basically, I believe he said that the design for this project has not really changed. You know, they've been a part of it from the beginning. And my question to you is, if you received a hearing examiner decision like this on one of your projects, would you have given them effectively the same design? Would you have resubmitted the same design?
No, frankly, it's insulting. I mean, the hearing examiner can understand what the proposal that was put in front of them was when it was put in front of them. We all discussed it in detail in the previous hearing examiner's testimony. So to just literally put the same design right back in front of us and say somehow it's changed and then admit that it hasn't changed, I don't understand. I would just never. Yes, our firm would not operate that way. If we receive this kind of judgment from an official or a building official or a planning official, someone, we would modify our designs to try to meet the standard as again, these are complex issues. These standards are complex. The Silverdale design standards admits they're complex. We would work with the stakeholders, as the Silverdale design standards ask you to figure mm-hmm. out how to meet these standards.
Okay. All right. I want to move on a little bit to the discussion. There's some discussion about parapets, and I believe they described it as, I'm sure if that was your poo-poo parapets or your subjective opinion that you did not care for parapets. Do you recall that testimony by Mr. McCormick?
Yes.
Okay. And he's implied that this is somehow, appropriate for the site or preferred in code? And what is your response to that?
Yeah, parapets, like any other architectural feature, are an arrow in our quiver as architects and designers to figure out how to design buildings. They function in many ways. Sometimes they're functional to hide HVAC equipment, for example, is proposed here, or sometimes they're used for fire safety reasons to separate portions of buildings. Sometimes they're just simply used as a way to attach the roofing in a way that allows the water to drain properly. So parapets are simply tools for us as designers. What the applicant was saying was we use them as roof modulation, but That's why the design standards envisioned looking to the neighboring single family residences for inspiration, because what you see in all of those residences is pitched roofs. And the Krista Shores project, which should not be referenced, but they did anyway, saw that. And when they designed their building, they picked up the pitched roof, you know, typology and incorporated it into their design. And then to say that
when you say should not be referenced, but was anyway, why is that?
Because the design standards clearly say that the reference should be the single family structures in the area. And Krista Shores is not a single family structure. So there are other ways to create roof modulation than parapets, pitched roofs being probably a very desirable strategy in this particular location to achieve roof modulation. In terms of screening mechanical units, that's practically laughable because the parapets only on one major side of the building, the south western side of the building. The entire northeastern side of the building doesn't have a parapet. And anybody uphill, which we talked about earlier, which is almost the entire waterfront district, is looking directly onto the roof with benefits of no parapets. And then finally, design-wise, I have to take real objection to the stylistic choices that have been made. They refer to them at times as classical or neo-classical, or they refer to them as postmodern. It's none of which is applicable in this particular as a design standard. We're not walking around Silverdale seeing classical structures on every street corner. It's a Northwest agrarian type of environment, and that's the type of architecture we see, and that should be what they're referencing, and they're not. They're just ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you're referring to those the classical elements, are you talking about what their descriptions in their architectural narrative
that they provide?
Okay.
Yes.
And so I'm just going to pull that up. That is the F, it's exhibit F39, that architectural narrative. And I believe, I don't, Mr. McCormick mentioned that, you know, they provided this neighbor, the context of the area in this narrative. Did you see any evidence of that in your review of their architectural narrative, that somehow these buildings relate to any of the surrounding context, be it residential or commercial?
The building that I saw that it most closely related to was a Taco Time, which to me is not an remotely appropriate reference for a residential building in this location.
Okay, so I'm just gonna go. Apologies for scrolling through it, but just want to get to some of the images that were referenced. So here was this is exhibit 39, page 10. This is the Krista Shores that you were referencing, where even though that's not appropriate because they're not residential single family, but they do have those pitched roofs.
They do, but then in the figure below, the figure note, figure one note below, they say that they decided not to use the sloped roofs.
Right. And do the slope roofs or the styles here, do they also have a kind of modulation as well?
Yes, they do.
Okay. All right. And then I just want to get to, all right, now I'm on page 12, which is the corner of Mickleberry and Buckland Hill. So here to the left of this image, we have some of the surrounding, this isn't the single family context, but the adjacent residential buildings. So even—
Commercial buildings.
Or commercial buildings, sorry, thank you. What can you tell me about these commercial buildings in relation to the context?
Well, they refer to the building on the corner, I think, is neoclassical. Of course, that's not neoclassical. That would be postmodern. I say this with a fair bit of authority. My partner and wife used to work for one of the most famous postmodern architects in history, Michael Graves. And I knew Michael before he passed away personally. And I can tell you this. And I also worked for associates of Robert Venturi, who was the other one of the most famous postmodern architects in the world. And this is a postmodern building, perhaps. It's certainly not neoclassical. So they just don't know what they're talking about. I'm sorry, but it's just, it's offensively wrong.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then even all, so we have the medical eye care clinic that's on the corner also has a pitched roof, correct?
Correct.
And then there's the Social Security Administration, just right down the road, also north of the project, also has a pitched roof. Right. Okay. This bank here on the corner, also pitched roof.
Sure.
Okay. And then it's not until we get over across the street, I think farther north, that we start to see, but these are all commercial buildings.
These are all commercial buildings. They don't, you know, don't apply by the standards. There's the Taco Time building. Yes.
Page 13.
Which they refer to as inspiration for their design. Mm-hmm. Doesn't apply. It's inappropriate. And it's just architecturally incorrect. It's the wrong analysis.
Okay. And then just maybe getting a little bit into Mr. McCormick's testimony, he did testify he's not an architect. He is an engineer. Do you have any sort of response or thoughts on how having an engineer weigh in on the architectural features might not necessarily be appropriate when we're doing this sort of design review?
Yeah. Architects by training deal with the aesthetic aspects of buildings. They deal with things about facades and modulation and historical context, and they understand stylistic traditions so that they can draw on those ideas and those traditions for contemporary designs that they produce. There's a whole aspect of what we do as architects I tried to point out earlier, referred to in the Silverdale design standards as complex issues, that civil engineers and structural engineers simply aren't trained in. That is not their training. That is not their job. That is not their role, professionally speaking. How can I opine as an architect on civil issues such as whether or not water flows faster through a pipe or in a culvert, which I believe I heard earlier today? I wouldn't. Why would we have a civil engineer then opine on whether buildings are stylistically appropriate, whether they have established a relationship to the existing context in the area? How they relate to the single family structures that are nearby. It's not simply work that's within their purview.
Okay. Great. Do you have anything else you want to add to that before we move on to the next topic here?
No, I don't believe so.
All right, so I want to talk a little bit about during Mr. McCormick's testimony, he pretty routinely characterized that made some comments about the density and how there it could be much more dense if they were to do mixed use. So really, they're not at the maximum. What is your response to that?
It's a mischaracterization of the zoning code, flat out. There was a little bit of bait and switch there. That was confusing and misleading and incorrect.
Okay, and why is that?
Because they have built to the maximum that's allowed in the zoning code. You could look at the land use table.
Okay, so I'm just going to pull up the land use table here. So I believe Mr. McCormick did as well. So let's just take a look at that. I have to stop share because I have to switch over to this. So are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, so this is the Kitsap County Code 17420058. And this is the density. And here is that discussion under the water in the waterfront district, you know, max density is 30 or 60 if mixed use, right?
Right. Yes. Okay. This project is not a mixed use project. I mean, it's we always, as a profession, customarily look at the use of the project, and those requirements for that use are what are applicable. We don't look at other types of projects and say, well, we could do that. Of course you could do that. There's some of their statements that there's all kinds of types of buildings that could be built on this site. Well, that's the case in many zones. Most zones, there are all kinds of different uses allowed. It's totally misleading. The density that is allowed for multifamily housing on this in the waterfront district is 30 units per acre. And the minimum density is 10.
So for this site, the minimum, sorry, I'm not great at math here, but roughly what is it, 54 units based on the 5.4 acres, somewhere in there.
So maybe depends on whether or not they get credit for the entire site. There is code that says that if there was a wetland on the site, they would have to reduce the size of the site. So then the number of units would go down.
Okay. And then also in the same way that they point to this max density for if they were to do a different development or if they were to do mixed use, how does that impact the minimum density discussion?
So it's interesting because they say we can't do any less than this, but we could, if we did a mixed use, we could do many more. Well, in fact, the mixed use argument that they make has that footnote 57 that's on the left there. Yep.
Okay.
Footnote 57 says something along the lines that if you are mixed use, there is no minimum density.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even with their argument that, look, we could do mixed use, well, then there's no minimum. Then they don't have to take one unit would be legal.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line is they're building at 30 dwelling units per acre. They're at the maximum. They're at the maximum allowed, period.
All right. Maybe just a few more. Sorry, too many tabs open.
Yeah, while you're doing that, Ms. Walston, can we go past five today? I don't even know if anybody wants to go past five today, but if we needed to, could we? Or is that kind of a hard close at that point?
I can go till about 5:45, and that's about it.
Okay, all right. And Ms. Clungeon, how much more time do you need?
I'm about to move on, I think, to possibly my last, one or two more issues. So okay. I would say about 20 minutes left.
Okay, that takes us just to about five then. And Mr. Lynn, do you have a lot across or?
Well, the longer it goes on, the more I think I have. On the other hand, I don't really know. It's certainly not insignificant, but it's also not, shouldn't be even 20 minutes. But I also don't sort of run the risk of being at the exhausting part of the day. I feel like we're kind of forced into a corner here where we don't really have ample time to do.
Yeah, so I mean, it looks like we're definitely going past five if we want to finish Mr. Adams' testimony today. I mean, is it possible to bring back Mr. Adams next week, Ms. Clungeon?
I believe we checked on that, but Mr. Adams next Tuesday.
I think Tuesday is set aside for the hydrogeologist, and I don't want to eat into that time with more of this.
Okay,
it was hard to schedule, and I don't want to lose that opportunity. So I think it would be Wednesday afternoon if.
Let's see. I'm just looking up what time there was agreed to here. Hold on. Okay, yeah, so we'd only agreed on Tuesday. So I guess overflow to Wednesday then, is that what we're saying?
I thought we had Wednesday afternoon that the parties had agreed to anyway, and I thought your calendar was free.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the time I got from Ms. Walston was Tuesday at 1:30 to 5. I don't have a Wednesday time. I can do Wednesday morning if that works for everybody. It sounds like if we're just doing Mr. Adams, we could do that probably in another hour, right?
Yeah, easily.
I'll have to check real quick and see. When we came up with a Tuesday, I had put out different availabilities next week. I wasn't really realizing we were looking for multiple in the week. So, yeah. But I can check on it here and, you know, you can continue this or whatever, but it'll take me a few minutes. So.
Okay, well, I think just so we know in general, Mr. Adams could come back on Wednesday or something, and we can figure out a specific time by Tuesday as to what that would be. I would guess something like 11 o'clock or something on Wednesday, or 10 o'clock Wednesday morning to finish him up. Just so that we all know.
Did he say he was available?
Yeah, Mr. Adams, does that work for you? Wednesday morning, probably?
Yes, I can do Wednesday morning.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And we'll lock that down, I guess, by email or by Tuesday, we'll lock that down. So, all right. Just so we all know we're going to be out of here by 5. I just wanted to know what our plans were here. Cause a lot of times people are kind of hesitant to stay past 5, at least on a Friday. So, all right, Ms. Clutchin, go ahead.
Well, just can I get clarification? Are we staying past 5 or are we setting up?
We are not. No, we're going to stop at 5 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. All right.
Or stop when you're done. Let's say that, because I think at this point, 20 minutes, you're going to be done at 5, it sounds like. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think we should. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we've discussed some of the misleading characterizations about density. I want to talk a little bit about Mr. McCormick's repeated statements about the, I'm not modulation, but the stepping down the property to one story. Do you recall that discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And
that was, I believe, related to how to relate to the surrounding context, residential context. And
correct.
And I believe that that's also repeated throughout. So not only Mr. McCormick's testimony, but in the record, in the architectural narrative that they provided to the county, they describe it as one story.
Correct.
What is your response to that characterization as this stepping down to one story?
It's just doesn't stand up to any plain understanding of the height of the building. It's simply not a one-story building.
Okay. And I'm going to share my screen just so that you can walk us through and show us why that is, what you're talking about. Okay, so I am looking at, this is exhibit F33, which is the exterior finishes. You see that?
I do.
Okay, and then I want to go, would this be the right exhibit to take a look at that, or would it also be the site plans, or?
This is fine. It would be easier for the record to look at the previous design, but I can try to point to it here because the previous design showed grid lines on the plans that divided up the facade into quadrants. It's easy to.
Yep. All right. I should have it. I have it easily accessible. So let me grab that. Right. So elevations from the previous design, I believe those are exhibit F4. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Hold on one sec. Let me rotate it. Flip it all around. Okay, so here.
Yes, these are a little bit easier to look at because you can see across the top they've numbered the different sections of the building with grid, what we call grid lines. The numbers are at the top drawing there.
So just for the record, this is exhibit F4 at page 450. But as we previously established in your testimony and kind of reflected by Mr. McCormick saying this, the plans haven't changed, we can sort of switch between these two and see that there are no substantial changes between these two designs. So we can rely on the this older yes. version.
Yeah, okay. I invite the examiner to examine both sets of plans. There's no difference in terms of building heights, mass, scale.
Okay.
So the grid numbers are numbered from left to right, confusingly enough, 12 to 1. The portion of the building that we're looking at on this top drawing labeled southwest elevation that's between grid lines 2 and 1 are the section of the building that is considered to step down. And the drawing below that, which is labeled northeast elevation, again, when you look at the between grid lines 1 and 2, we're looking at the same portion of the building. We're just looking at the two opposite sides of the same building. So we can see quite clearly also on the right-hand side of both of these drawings that there are these datum lines that call out the different levels of the building. So it says roof, third floor, second floor, first floor, basement. So we can tell where the stories are in the building. And clearly from on the southwest elevation, the top drawing between grid lines 2 and 1, we see we have a second floor portion of the building, a first floor portion of the building, and the basement portion of the building, which is partially hidden below the grade. And this is the southwest elevation is showing the downhill side of the building. On the uphill side, we clearly see again between the second and third floor datum points, we have a second story and a first floor as well. And we can also review the floor plan documents to show that this is not a throwaway story on top of the first story. It contains a bedroom and a bathroom and a full staircase leading up to it in circulation. So it is a complete story as speaking plainly in terms of one's perception of the height of the building. Anybody that walks up to this can say it's a two-story building from the uphill side and a three-story building from below it.
Okay. And then I'm just going to just quick want to reference the architectural narrative where I believe it does refers to it as one story, right?
The previous page you had, yeah. Project cascades down from the zoning code acceptable massing to one story. I don't understand how they can make that statement.
Mm-hmm. And this was provided to the county. So the county's decision was also based on this characterization of one story.
Correct.
So that characterization or what they relied on was not correct.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay.
And I also believe there's further references to it. Page 8. Wasn't there something about page that 8? In the same exhibit?
Three story with basement, one story, and finally to one story with basement level.
Yeah, and what's especially misleading about that statement is they talk about two-stepping from three-story to two-story, and finally one-story, as if the building is stepping down two stories. Three minus one is two. But that's not what we see in the elevation.
Okay. All right, do you have anything else that you want to say on the one-story characterization?
I think just if you still have the floor plans on your screen available, sure. It would be nice to just simply look at what that second story contains.
Sure.
So this is the second floor plan.
This is also just for the record, this is exhibit F4 at page 458. Okay.
We found the F floor plans. That's good. So again, I'll point to the grid numbers that they're at the top of this drawing. We have 1 and 2, which was our reference points for analyzing the elevations. So we're talking about the structure between grid lines one and two, and we can see that we have a bedroom, a bathroom, a closet, and a full stair, all illustrated near the term two-bedroom loft 200, plus circulation along the windows, and then the overlook down to the lower floor. But that overlook does not really mean that there's any less bulk or scale or height in the building. It just simply means that the people in the bedroom don't get a peaceful night's sleep when the TV's on downstairs. So it's a full story by any common understanding of what that means.
Okay.
And then I would reject any kind of arguments that by the building code, it's not a story, because as I tried to mention earlier, the building code defines things differently, and it has nothing to do with what we're talking about here today. And that's the lower floor of that unit between grids one and two, where we have, there's one and two at the top of that drawing. Yep. You're going to say it's page 157 or?
Yeah, 457, page 457.
Yep. We have the stair that's going up to the second story. We also have a bathroom at this level, a kitchen, what's probably a living room, and a bedroom on this unit.
Okay.
So this is a nice two-bedroom unit.
Two stories.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also, as we can see here, that also has a basement.
There is a basement below it. It's unclear what is contained within the basement. Most of the other units contain living units on the lower floor. This unit seems to have a basement and or some structural, but it's the same height as all the other units.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I can just go up to show that, yeah, where there's something.
It's labeled as crawl space, but however, the drawings are not particularly clear here, because we don't have any resolution, and these cross sections that are referenced EA314 are not in the record from what I can tell, so we're not able to tell what's going on there.
Okay, and then back here, based on this, this basement level is the rest of the building. It's high enough to have a whole apartment in it, right?
Yeah. And then, okay. Yeah, there's no change. So again, if we look at the datum lines on the right-hand side of these drawings, we see that the basement line is continuous all through the project. In fact, all of the floor levels are completely continuous through the entire project. There's no modulation in the floor levels of this project.
So we can assume that this crawl space is the size of an apartment that's immediately adjacent to it as well.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Okay. Move on to my next. There was some discussion about screening and fencing and how that helped basically with compatibility, or somehow satisfied that standard. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I believe I was called the task that I poo-pooed fencing or screening. And I will admit that I was not enthusiastic about fencing and screening, simply because we're talking about the Silverdale design standards. And the standards don't envision the use of fences or screening as part of the standard. I think I did a quick word search when I was doing my research. There's one reference to fence around a wetland, and there's one or two references around screening around industrial properties, but it's almost wholly absent from the design standards. It doesn't matter that they're putting a fence or a 10-foot buffer or a 20-foot landscape buffer or 30. The design standards are addressing the designs of the buildings and their surrounding sites. And so they don't get credit for meeting the land use code and putting the required landscaping buffer that is a requirement of land use code. They don't get credit to then ignore the design standards. The design standards are a separate body of code that they continue to ignore for some reason. They don't address how the building addresses meets the standards. It's a little like saying, oh, we put in windows because the building code says you have to have windows because people need to see light and be able to get out of the building in case there's a fire and blocking the door. Oh, so we put in windows. So that gets us off the hook for relating to single family houses, because single family houses have windows too, right? We're good, right? No, you're not good. It doesn't work. It's a meaningless argument. And so, yeah, I poo-pooed fences and screening, not because I don't like fences and screening, but because it has nothing to do with the Silverdale design standards.
Okay, I think that's most of my, but Mr. Adams, before I let you go, is there anything else that came up in Mr. McCormick's testimony that you would like to respond to?
I just would like them to address in a meaningful way the design standards. They have not done it. They don't get to refer to the land use code and say, we're good, we've met the land use code. That is not an acceptable response. They have to meet all the codes, and the design standards are part of the body of code they need to respond to, and they need to do it in an architectural way. And the applicant has not demonstrated that they have an architectural understanding of how to meet these design standards.
Okay. And also, I know I said I was just done, but I found one more bullet point that I had regarding pedestrian connectivity. I just want to check here. In Mr. McCormick's testimony, he seemed to think that all that was needed was a description of the materials or of the existing pedestrian plan. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Thought it was more information, or that it somehow needed to be on its own sheet, some separate plan. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. In your previous testimony, at the last hearing before the hearing examiner, was your focus on needing to know what material it was, or was it on the actual utility and flow of the pedestrian plan as it was depicted on the various plans from the applicant?
It was on the latter. It was on the how it's located on the site, how the various components are connected, how difficult it is to move around the site, potentially dangerous, how much interaction there is between pedestrians and traffic. Those were the issues, not what the materiality of the sidewalks were.
Okay. And so in not at all changing the pedestrian paths or plans here, they have, in your opinion, have they addressed the hearing examiner's decision?
Now, I'm confused how the plan seemed to suggest that they were going to paint some stripes on it, which I see as wholly inadequate. And then I was cross-examined to suggest that isn't it normal for further design to take place, or don't you see that it's a condition that they would have to paint stripes on it? It's small potatoes stuff. It's stuff that perhaps an engineer starts to think about striping, but as an architect, I'm really concerned about the larger issues of how people move around large properties like this. And again, this is 2.5 city blocks in size. I don't understand why we can't see a grid and street pattern and a sidewalk pattern with pedestrians separated from cars by planter strips the same way we see in downtown Old Town, which is, by the way, something that this Silverdale design standards ask for, that see that topology from the Old Town District applied to properties like this.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Adams. I don't have any more questions.
Okay. Well, I got a message from Ms. Walston that the clerk's office can't do Wednesday morning. They are available Thursday morning. Mr. Adams, would that work for you and everybody else?
Yes, I could make Thursday work.
So should we say 9 o'clock? Does that work for everybody?
Yes.
Mr. McClung? For Clungeon?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay, great. All right. Yeah. So we'll plan on Mr. Black or Mr. Adams' testimony to be completed then next Thursday morning at 9 a.m.
Sorry, just a time are we reserving? Sorry.
It's going to be just Mr. Adams on Thursday?
Yeah, well, it depends when we finish on Tuesday, I guess.
I was going to say, do we anticipate an entire... I think there are only two witnesses scheduled for Tuesday right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're your witnesses, so you tell me if you're going to be finished.
No, it's Mr. Lynn. Yeah.
One of them is mine, and then one of them's rebuttal from Mr. Matthew.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
That should be short. This will be the third time he's testified. So.
Mm-hmm.
Is that everything, Mr. Lynn? Do you think?
I'm just wondering if we could maybe, I mean, I don't know how long it's going to go, but if we could maybe, we could try to have Mr. Adams wrap up on Tuesday if there's time as well, right?
We sort of have him on standby in case Mr. Lynn finishes that day. If that works for everybody else, that'd be great. Yeah.
I'd be happy with that and delighted if we could finish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Adams, are you available on Tuesday afternoon?
I guess I told you I was, didn't I? Or where
yeah, were we at? Feel free to, if that's changed, we can just...
I'm not available to 2:30 on Tuesday afternoon.
You what?
I'm not available until Tuesday at 2:30 I'm available, or Tuesday morning I'm available.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, I didn't realize Mr. Lynn was going to bring some witnesses. So this is Sir Rebuttal then, Mr. Lynn? Is this what
we're doing? No, this was the witness that we were going to have on Friday. And then Mr. Matthew wanted to hear his testimony. So we're calling it out of order. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. All right. Great. All right. It's hard to keep track now at this point.
A little bit hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. All right. Okay. Well, we will see you then next Tuesday as scheduled. I think we're done for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.